All right. Good to see everyone. Well, okay. Before I actually start talking about what the Hungarian Revolution was in the first place, I just want to quickly establish what it wasn't. So first things first, the Hungarian Revolution was not a fascist uprising by a counter-revolutionary mob, as was asserted by the Stalinist communist parties of the time, including Australia's very own CPA. Nor was it simply a struggle against all things communism or a nationalist uprising against foreign intervention, as was claimed by the likes of Viktor Orban recently and George W. Bush, who used this revolution to justify imperialist wars and anti-migrant racism. Yeah, shame. And I think we just need to say that, all of these interpretations of the revolution, frankly, spit in the face of the Hungarian workers who fought and died in this revolution. And we need to set the record straight. The Hungarian Revolution of 1956 was a genuine workers' revolution against Stalinist rule. The workers of Hungary rose up not for the restoration of capitalism, but for a truly democratic society under workers' control. And although the revolution was ultimately crushed, it dealt a massive, massive blow to the long-standing myth that Russia was a socialist nation and is therefore a very important moment in socialist history. So that's why we're talking about the Hungarian Revolution today. I'm going to begin by talking about Russia's occupation of Eastern Europe post-World War II, the impacts that that had on the Hungarian working class, and the events leading up to the outbreak of the revolution. Then I'll go through what actually happened, including workers' resistance against Russian intervention and the formation of workers' councils. And then I'll end with how the revolution was defeated, the international response to the revolution, and what lessons we can draw out of it. So let's get started. After World War II, Russia emerged as the second most powerful nation in the world. The spoils that Russia gained from this war included various Eastern European countries that were previously ruled by Nazi Germany. Russia liberated these countries from Nazism by occupying them and establishing the Soviet bloc. And Hungarian workers didn't oppose the Red Army when it took over Hungary at this time. Before World War II, actually, their lives had been wrecked by the fascist dictator named Admiral Miklos Horthy, who persecuted thousands of socialists and trade unionists. When the Second World War broke out, Horthy allied with Nazi Germany, and the breakdown of this alliance led to the Nazis occupying Hungary. So after decades of misery, the Hungarian people were desperate for change. And with the 1917 Russian Revolution still in memory, they trusted Russia's promise of liberation. But there was nothing liberating about Russian occupation. It did not usher in a new era of socialism. The same institutions used to oppress workers before the war remained intact. The difference was who controlled them. Instead of Horthy, it was the Hungarian Communist Party that carried out the same program of exploitation and repression with the backing of Moscow. The Communist Party carried out this program through the state machine. Their primary tool of oppression was the police, which they controlled through the Ministry of Interior. They used the police to establish control over and instill fear within the working class. And this includes the secret police, or the AVH, which was notorious for just absolutely brutalizing the working class. Many members of the AVH actually previously served under the Horthy regime, and they were disproportionately more well off than the average Hungarian worker. And to just put that into perspective, the average worker at the time earned about 1,000 forints a month, while the average AVH soldier earned 3,000 forints. And if you were an officer, you could get up to 12,000 forints. So needless to say, workers absolutely hated the AVH, hated the police. But the Communist Party didn't have full control over of the state immediately after the war. In fact, in the 1945 National Assembly elections, they only received 17% of the vote. And in comparison, the Social Democratic Party got 17%, and the Smallholders Party, which is like the Peasants Party, they got 56%. While they held the Ministry of Interior, they still needed to get rid of their enemies in government. And so the hardline Stalinist Prime Minister, Maria Sarkozy, described using salami tactics to slice away at the Smallholders Party bit by bit. He would unmask his opponents as fascists, reveal their crimes, and remove them from their posts. And at the same time, the Communist Party also merged with the Social Democratic Party, after which they just simply dissolved the Social Democrats from within. And it was through these sorts of tactics that the Communist Party was able to take over the Hungarian state apparatus. Aside from that, dissent became a crime punishable by death. Like the other Stalinist regimes, the Hungarian Communist Party carried out party purges. And so between 1948 and 1950, 483,000 members were expelled for allegedly betraying the party line. Show trials were held during this period, the most high profile of which was the trial of Laszlo Reich in 1949, who at the time was the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Like many others, Reich was accused of being, he was accused of treason for being a Titoist fascist. And it was obvious to those who knew him that this wasn't true. But as Peter Fryer, a British communist, described in his book, The Hungarian Tragedy, the reasons for his trial were political. The first reason was to back Moscow during the Tito-Stalin split. And the second was to make a lesson out of those who dared to oppose the party leadership. Reich had doubts about Rákosi, and for that, he was punished and executed. The Reich trial shook workers to the core. The sheer intensity of political repression at the time was suffocating. And that's why, as we get closer to the revolution, Reich basically became a martyr, a symbol of political freedom and democracy for the Hungarian working class. So there's the political sort of aspect of it. But then workers were also subject to severe economic exploitation. Russia regarded Hungary and its other satellite states as cheap sources of raw materials and manufactured goods. These countries were forced to pay reparations, which meant providing Russia with millions and millions of tons of industrial and agricultural products. The Iron Curtain imposed by the U.S. during the Cold War also forced Hungary to trade with Russia. And so Hungarian exports were sold to Russia below, like way below market price, while Russian goods were imported way above market price. And besides this, workers were paid by piecework, strikes were illegal. The penalties for resisting their exploitation were severe. And so all of this led to a massive deterioration of living standards for Hungarian workers who suffered through economic crisis, food shortages, and hyper-exploitation in their workplaces. Clearly, this was nothing, absolutely nothing, like the socialism that Hungarians were promised. The tide started to change after Stalin's death on the 6th of March, 1953. Workers across Eastern Europe saw an opportunity to rise up and rebel against their conditions. So first came the short-lived Pilsen Uprising in Czechoslovakia on the 31st of May, where workers at the Skoda arms factory went on strike for 3 days against the government. And 2 weeks after that was the East German Uprising, where over 200,000 workers across 330 factories struck against cuts to living standards and state repression. And while these protests were ultimately crushed by Russian tanks, these caused great concern for Moscow. And they came to the conclusion that they needed to de-Stalinize, to tone down that political repression. And so in Hungary, they replaced Rákosi with the reformist Imre Nagy as prime minister. Nagy immediately provided a series of concessions to the Hungarian people, which included revising Hungary's five-year plan, releasing political prisoners, and restoring freedoms for the peasantry. These concessions went too far for Moscow, however, and Rákosi was reinstated in 1955. But it was that initial relaxation of the party line that opened up the space for political discussion. Criticism of the party intensified, especially as Rákosi began whittling away at the reforms that Najib had initially introduced. And this discontent was further exacerbated by Nikita Khrushchev's secret speech in early 1956, in which he criticized Stalin and his cult of personality. So during this time, it was young communist students in the Petofi Circle and the Writers' Union, which played a really important role in encouraging dissent against the party bureaucracy. The students, disillusioned with the party leadership, held mass meetings to discuss their lack of political freedom under the Rákosi government and why he had to be overthrown. The writers wrote articles for the magazine called Irodami Usag, literally called the Literary Gazette. So it was actually quite an apolitical magazine. But they wrote articles for it in which they demanded absolute political freedom for workers, an end to Rákosi's regime of tyranny, and the reinstatement of Najib as prime minister. These articles were so popular among workers that a black market developed to sell copies for cheap. And eventually the sense of anger and dissatisfaction became so widespread that even the Communist Party newspaper began publishing articles that were critical of Rákosi, to the point where the Central Committee began accusing the writers of spreading confusion with the provocative content of their articles. And the climax of this political ferment presented itself on the 23rd of October in 1956. Students in Budapest organized a protest in solidarity with a mass movement of Polish workers for greater political freedom and improved economic conditions. 50,000 people gathered in different parts of the city and congregated at the statue of Józef Bem, a Polish general who fought with Hungarians during the 1848 Hungarian Revolution. As the crowd grew, people began stepping up to the foot of the statue to deliver impromptu speeches. One such speaker was a member of the Communist Party, Peter Verez, who read out a resolution of the Writers' Union. And this resolution demanded a broad series of reforms, including equality between Hungary and the USSR, the removal of Rákosi, free elections, and workers' control of the factories. The crowd applauded and cheered as he stepped off the statue. Shamefully, the first secretary of the Communist Party, Erno Gero, denounced the protests as an attempt to destroy democracy, to undermine the working class. And the sheer audacity of these accusations just left people speechless. And in a wave of outrage, the protesters decided to march to the Budapest radio station to broadcast their demands across the country. And this is where it starts to get a little fun, because as these people marched to the radio station, a section of about 3,000 people broke off from the main demonstration and instead marched to the statue of Stalin in City Park. And, you know, they're in great spirits, they're singing and laughing on the way, and they brought a ladder and some rope, and they just tore the statue down. They loaded the statue on a lorry, and it was dumped in front of the National Theater in the city, where the where other workers on the streets decided to just beat the absolute shit out of it. And the only thing that remained of the statue was Stalin's boots, in which some of the workers decided to plant the flag of the revolution, which is just the old Hungarian flag with the coat of arms cut out of it. So that's fun to see. But moving back to the main demonstration, eventually they get to the radio station. Outside of the station stood about 100,000 people. A crowd grew like doubled in size. And a whole bunch of them were actually just workers who, you know, were getting out of their shift and just returning from their factories. And they bumped into the crowd and just decided to go along with it. They were faced with local police and ABH soldiers who had blocked and occupied the station. But despite this, the protesters were undeterred. They demanded a delegation be let in to broadcast their demands. And after an hours-long standoff, the ABH eventually fired onto the crowd. The protesters fought back, overpowering and seizing arms from the workers, seizing arms from the police, to defend themselves. Defenseless, many of the police and soldiers simply handed over their arms and stood back. They neither supported the revolutionaries nor fought against them. Meanwhile, night shift workers at the arms factories stole guns and ammunition from their workplaces and distributed them among the crowd. Thousands of workers and students formed groups and took part in street fights against the ABH. Some of these groups spread out to occupy intersections and set up roadblocks around the city. Any cars that had ABH soldiers in them were seized by the workers, and the soldiers were thrown out and left to fend for themselves. And I think it was the most impressive thing of all of this, really, was that it was all spontaneously organized. You can imagine at the time there was no sort of organization to really, plan all of this out. So that's quite incredible, actually. Overnight, Moscow invited Najib to take over as prime minister. And the very next morning, Najib announced that he called in the Red Army to restore order. So, the workers, they felt betrayed, of course, but they also became more determined to keep fighting on. As Russian tanks rolled down the streets, workers found ways to push them back. Some built barricades and dropped Molotov cocktails from apartment buildings. Others fraternized with the Russian soldiers, who were shocked that they were firing at ordinary workers instead of fascists. Sections of the Russian and Hungarian armies started defecting to the workers. And those who didn't suffered a terrible fate. In some places, workers and students surrounded their local ABH barracks, beat them to death, and hung their corpses upside down for all to see. Those who walked by the corpses later on would spit at them, kick their corpses, stub cigarette butts on their bodies. You get a sense of actually how much, these soldiers were just hated by workers at the time. At this time as well, hundreds of councils and factory committees were formed around the country. These councils quickly linked up to form a network of district-based revolutionary councils, and later a central workers' council was formed, consisting of delegates from the district councils. In the rural agricultural areas, peasants also formed their own peasants' councils. The peasants also had an interest in fighting back against the Stalinist regime. They were forced into collective farms that were ruled over quite brutally by state bureaucrats. And so while their politics were more conservative than that of the workers, they were ready to unite with workers in the cities to struggle for a more liberated society. And these councils, they became hotbeds of discussion and debate. Elections were conducted with enthusiasm and excitement. And for many, it was their first ever taste of democracy. Peter Fryer recounted how long it took for the Babona Peasants Council to elect its committee. He sat during the elections, and one of the delegates ended up approaching him, and this delegate said, I'm sorry, this is taking so long, but you have to understand, we haven't got any practice in electing people. And, if you're in that situation, what else could you say other than, take your time, good on you, actually. Yeah, you elect your committee, however long that takes. And so once these committees were elected, they would discuss basically every single question under the sun, from things like, how do we get food and arms into the city? What sort of demands should we be putting to the government to, things like, should we keep calling each other comrade? Or is that kind of problematic just given the current political situation at the moment? Just all different sort of questions. And they would discuss this for hours in ways that they never could have before. So every workers' council, they drew up a list of demands to put to the government, And no two lists would be the same. You know, some of these councils, they called for a parliamentary democracy. Some of them expressed support for Imran Nagy, but they were all united in making these key demands. So the abolition of the AVH, the complete withdrawal of Russian troops, political and civil liberty, free trade unions and political organizations, amnesty for all the insurrectionists, and workers' control of production. So you can see, you know, why Peter Fryer described them as both, you know, organs of insurrection and organs of popular self-government, which the armed people trusted. And so it was through these workers' councils that a nationwide general strike was launched. This general strike shut down 80% of industrial production for over a month, which made this one of the most complete and sustained general strikes in history. And this was really important in keeping the struggle going, especially after the second round of Russian tanks rode in on the 4th of November. The second invasion saw the deliberate targeting of working class districts in Budapest. Homes were shelled at point blank range. Hospitals started overflowing with wounded civilians, and people were beginning to starve. Within a few days, hundreds had died and ammunition was running low. But despite everything, workers refused to give up the strike. They maintained a tight grip on the central services and production through the workers' councils, and they were ready to completely shut the nation down if their demands weren't met. Eventually, the government was forced to recognize the Central Workers' Council and negotiate with them. The new prime minister installed by Moscow, Janusz Kadar, offered to withdraw Russian troops and exit the Warsaw Pact if the council ended the strike. There were internal debates about whether to accept this deal. So some of the more moderate workers argued for an end to the strike to allow Kadar to some time to show his intentions. Meanwhile, the most radical of the workers saw an opportunity to keep pushing for more and wanted to maintain the strike come what may. So this went on for weeks. You know, the negotiations, they went on for weeks and weeks, but this proved fruitless. The more concessions that Kadar made, the more the workers' councils demanded of him. And Moscow was just getting sick of it. You know, any longer and the revolution would just spiral out of their control. It had to be crushed. So throughout December, Russian troops and the AVH launched mass crackdowns on protests and strikes. Kadar declared martial law and forcefully dissolved many of the workers' councils. The death penalty was announced for anyone who refused to work or even agitated for strike action. And thousands of workers, students, and intellectuals were arrested, tried, and executed. And so the Hungarian Revolution was violently crushed at the hands of supposed communists. And just quickly, I think it's worth noting the international response to the Hungarian Revolution. Because, well, if you look up Western news articles about the revolution, you'll find, you know, all sorts of praise about the Hungarian rebels fighting against Soviet invasion. I mean, it was featured on the cover of Times magazine, for fuck's sake. And, you know, like, while it's true that what the workers did was really, really heroic and incredible, it's quite telling that none of the Western governments actually came to their aid when they needed it, especially during the second Russian invasion. And, well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is because, well, the priorities of these governments were simply elsewhere in the world. As the revolution was happening, Britain and France were busy bombing Egypt after Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. So that's quite shameful. But then the other reason, which I think is more important, is it was actually revealed in a New York Times report that said the view prevailing among United States officials was that evolution towards freedom in Eastern Europe would be better for all concerned than revolution, though nobody was saying this publicly. So basically, it didn't matter that, you know, Hungarian workers were fighting against the Russian army because the Western capitalists are also fundamentally opposed to workers' power. So there's that. Obviously, really terrible, but I think, you know, what's actually probably more egregious, actually, is the conduct of the various Western communist parties at the time, you know, who parroted Moscow's lies about the revolution, that the Hungarian workers were violent fascists out there to destroy socialism. You know, if you've read Hungarian Tragedy, you would know that the reason why the book was published in the first place was because the British Communist Party refused to publish Peter Fryer's reports about what was happening on the ground. They refused to reveal the truth that the USSR was violently suppressing a genuine workers' revolution. And any reports that did make it into the party newspaper were heavily edited to conceal the situation, to conceal the Hungarian workers' criticisms of the Stalinist regime. And so when the truth finally did come out, when the mass slaughter of the Hungarian working class became known to the world, it was severely disillusioning. Hundreds of thousands across the world left the communist parties disgusted by the fact that they'd been lending political support to a murderous, tyrannical regime. The vast majority, obviously, you know, like some of these people, you know, would go on to become Trotskyists. Some of them would just turn into liberals, but the vast majority of them just dropped out of politics altogether. And while that's certainly tragic, it was ultimately, I think, a step forward for the left. The Hungarian Revolution played a big role in undermining the USSR. And the idea that bureaucratic state capitalism is what socialists should aspire to achieve. It opened up the space for revolutionary politics to flourish once again, a set of politics that supports socialism, not from above, but from below, that aims to dismantle the capitalist state and establish organs of working class power that fights for the self-emancipation of the working class everywhere around the world. So, to sum up, the Hungarian Revolution represents a lot of tragedies, whether it's the horrific oppression of workers under Stalinist rule or the brutal defeat of an incredible workers' revolution. But it also represents the creativity, courage, and tenacity of the working class in the struggle for a better world. The formation of workers' councils shows that an alternative to both Stalinist state capitalism and Western liberal capitalism is possible, but it's workers who have to lead that struggle. And finally, while it wasn't the first revolt of workers in Eastern Europe against Stalinism, it was the most significant revolutionary movement, which clearly destroyed the myth that Stalinism was socialism and undermined the grip of Stalinism on the international socialist movement. I'll just leave it there.